I'm your host, Blake Collier, and on today's episode of 88 Names Podcast, Matt Ruff and I will speak to Brandon Oldenburg, Chief Creative Officer for Flight School Studios, about his 2012 Oscar-winning animated short, The Fantastic Flying Books of Mr. Morris Lesmore, shifting landscapes of virtual and augmented realities and how they have changed the art of illustration and storytelling, the potential drawbacks of the mediums, and how immersive technology can help people understand the experiences of those in the past. Join us for this wonderful conversation with a pioneer on the front lines of VR technology. Hello, listeners. This is the 88 Names Podcast, and I'm your host, Blake Collier, film critic and freelance journalist. The short-run podcast series is aimed at exploring the ideas, questions, and practical applications of virtual and augmented reality as we celebrate the release of 88 Names, the new novel by author Matt Ruff. This series will feature interviews with a diverse collection of guests who have some unique angles on this growing field. There is a thread of history which, if tugged on, reveals a very human ambition. This ambition has both practical and theoretical tendrils that seek to place humanity within new technological and metaphysical spaces. What is this ambitious thread, you ask? It is the human need to transcend physical boundaries and dimensions. Whether we are talking about the mathematical concepts of the XY-axis, or falling down a Reddit rabbit hole discussing interdimensional beings and time travel. At its core, the search reveals a need for renewed mystery and enchantment, that there is more than just our individual stories banging around in a large cosmic glass jar. The practical parts of the search involves ventures as diverse as space exploration, the ever-growing video game market, and recent plans for three-dimensional printed housing projects as a form of working towards solving a homeless crisis. All of these things are a search to move into and through spaces that we have never entered before. 88 Names taps into this very human endeavor, taking us into a future world where it seems a good portion of our lives are lived out online in the worlds of virtual and augmented realities. The novel follows a Sherpa, or guide, named John Chu, who finds himself embroiled in a potential plan for world domination by various superpowers, all while attempting to keep his VR-based business alive and make it profitable in this brave new world. So join Matt Ruff and I as we dig into what makes the virtual world so compelling and what that says about humanity as a whole.
GC Records proudly sponsors this podcast. To stream or download over 20 years of music, head to gcrecords.bandcamp.com.
So, Brandon,
yes.
For those who don't know who you are, can you give us a little bit about yourself and how you got into illustrating, designing, directing, and ultimately immersive technology?
Yeah, so I got into all this stuff at a young age. My parents saw that I like to draw and I love movies, and I asked a certain number of questions about how all that worked, and they if they didn't have the answer, then they at least sought out the answer or put a tool in my hand to let me play with it so I could start to figure out on my own. So whether it was drawing at the kitchen table or making home movies in my backyard with a Super 8, I just was fascinated with both of those mediums. And then they kind of coalesced and collided when I needed to figure out where I was going to go for college. And I was torn whether to do film school or art school. Mm-hmm. And the decision was made by a scholarship. So I went to art school. I went to Ringling College of Art. And there I quickly became enamored with animation because that's the collision of both storytelling and, you know, filmmaking, but, you know, bringing your drawings to life. And right out of college, reconnected with some friends from high school and helped grow this company we call Real Effects. And now 25 years later, it's now in some ways four studios in one and one division. I'm creatively heading up, which is the section we call Flight School.
Okay.
And Flight School tells stories using emerging technologies and innovation. The real effects traditional side making animated features. And then there's a commercial division called Attack Plan that's like high-end design, motion graphics studio. It has a lot of animation in their content. And then there's also a fourth section called Lodge 26 that does branded brands. So they help brands find their identity, whether it's through the packaging design or their the full presentation that they may have to their to the world for a brand. So they even help invent brands like Shinola, for example, or reinvent brands like Filson.
And it was in, I believe it was 2012 when you won the Oscar.
That's right. It was 2012.
So, yeah. so tell me a little bit about that.
Well, almost 10 years
ago.
What
was that like?
your questions require like so much, and I don't want to eat up all your time because I could talk for hours on the subject. But it's for me, being able to receive an Oscar. First and foremost, it's all the peers in the industry basically patting you on the back, saying, "Hey, you did great. Keep doing that." But what it means for a kid like me who started out in Little League, basically in the backyard with my Super 8. It's like getting to go to the World Series. Mm-hmm. And it's also like, bottom of the ninth, bases loaded, home run. It's like all of those emotions bundled up into this experience. But not being a sports person, I'm even surprised I even made that analogy work because I don't know sports very well. But what I'm getting at is it's like having your first child. It's like getting married. It's all of those emotions bundled up into one atomic explosion.
Oh, I bet.
That's really cool.
So how has VR and other immersive technology changed the landscape of stuff like illustration and filmmaking? And are there aspects that you would never have expected 10 years ago that you're now capable of realizing today?
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. Especially, it's interesting you brought up illustration. You know, Quill and then painting in virtual reality is an exciting, unique medium. And I should say animating in virtual reality with art that you're drawing is like an exciting, emerging, interesting space, really interesting space. And no one does it better than this guy named Goro Fujita. It's incredible what he does, and he does it so quickly and effortlessly. And I believe he's paid by Google to just do this every day. And it's amazing what he turns out, but it is a reinvention and a rewiring of your brain. And it does require the discipline to do it every day, I think, to get good at it. And I don't have the time or attention span, I think, to pull that one off. But I am amazed at what's happening in that space. And there's every day there's more and more people doing that in that space. And it's really beautiful because it's like you get to walk amongst a person's painting that's living. From an illustration standpoint, that's amazing. From filmmaking standpoint, telling stories in VR is a whole new way to think. And I think the medium still hasn't delivered on its promise. It hasn't for decades. Like when we first got to put on a VR headset at Dave & Buster's back in 1989 to now, it's obviously made leaps and bounds in progress and development. But still, is it really truly this new exciting thing that everybody's going to be able to do? No, we're still just touching like 1% of the population for doing this. And there's so many hurdles you have to leap to get into it. And with Quest launching this last year, it's made it easier, but still, we got, I think, a ways to go. And for people to create businesses and build business models around being a profitable company that just creates content for VR, that's a difficult space to live in. And so at Flight School, we don't hang our hat on any one of these tools. And it's important to call them tools because you can't just treat it like it's just this thing your whole business revolves around. VR is a paintbrush. AR is a paintbrush. And as storytellers and as visual storytellers, it's just one of the things you have in your tool belt. and you use it when it's appropriate. And that's, I think that's the discipline and the way we view it and the way we try to work with it. And when it's appropriate, it's cool. And when you have the right space for the right audience to consume it, it's really cool. And if now we are able to do it with multiple people at one time, it's very compelling. But to set all that up and to figure out how to monetize it is still really tricky. Yeah. And it's unknown territory.
Wow. Yep.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to ask about, I'm still really fascinated by the difference. I'm still new to all of these technologies, but I'm curious about the distinction between VR and AR, and what do you think in terms of the difference in their creative potential and what sort of applications you'd use them for?
Right. So AR is really exciting, as well as VR and all these things. And that nowadays people are saying XR, and I guess it's just adding to your reality or completely immersing you in that reality, making the unseen seen, and being able to toggle all these things on or off, and to do it in a way that works with your true reality that you're in, and to work with the geometry of the space, and to be knowledgeable of the space you're in. And being aware is really interesting. So to tell stories, for example, I always use this as an example. We haven't gotten there yet, but it's something I want us to see happen. First off, all the AR technology, there's still this tech in your way. And for AR to really feel like it's working, it's almost all that has to evaporate and go invisible. And you don't have to, you shouldn't think about it. You shouldn't think about this heavy thing on your head. You shouldn't think about that the peripheral is really weak and it's really tight and you don't really get the full peripheral of it. And you don't want to think, oh, what's that hot thing in my pocket that's burning up because of the RAM, or that hot thing on my back. You just need to go, you know what? I'm there, I'm present, and I'm with all of this stuff that I guess could be considered a hallucination. So what I would love to see, this is my example, is like to walk the streets of the French Quarter at night, come to some sort of ghost tour, but then to be outfitted with some spectacles, and then to then see Jean Lafitte in a carriage ride down the street in the glowing, as a glowing ghost, and then to follow him around the corner, and then to look up to the left in a balcony or a window of a 16th century building, and then to see a woman lean out and wave at the carriage. And for it to know where you are, what street corner you're on, and to have that sound design be three-dimensional sound design based on which way your head's looking, and to have that all play out and work with the set that is reality would be amazing and is totally plausible. But controlled environments and 6G may be required.
Right.
and right now, to pull it off, definitely a controlled environment is where you can start to scratch the surface of delivering on the promise of that. But to put it out in the real world is really tricky right now.
Do you think either of the two technologies has an advantage in terms of broader acceptance, you know, and a sort of more widespread acceptance by the public? And do you have a favorite?
I think everybody's trying to still find their way. And right now, for example, Magic Leap is trying to make that connection in industry. And I understand that to be like people in factories, people in giant warehouses, and being able to, again, see the unseen or learn something quicker, whether it's how to build a jet engine or track down that one package that needs to get where it never needs to get to have X-ray vision and work with complex systems and to try to help give you that X-ray vision to understand where to go and how to connect two dots. That's, I guess, is potentially where that could work. And at least that's where I guess much smarter people who are immersed in this are starting to gravitate towards. At least that's what I'm observing from the outside looking in.
Okay.
From VR standpoint, I think the most exciting space personally is where multiple people can do it at the same time. And I personally like it when you blend the two. There's this funny feature that the Quest VR headset has, and now all of them are starting to do it, where you have pass-through camera, and it shows you the world you're in. It sort of has predator vision, where it's like a black and white version of the world you're standing in, even though it looks like your eyes are completely covered.
Right.
And I would love to think that you can walk through a space and you could toggle that on or off, fade it in and out, and work with set pieces that you've built, and then to sometimes make it feel like it's a hologram. Other times make it feel like you've just completely gone into another world, or you've passed through a portal into another space. And you do that with, 10 other people, and you're on a mission. That gets to me. I get really excited thinking about that.
So in what manner was virtual reality film content shot 10 years ago? And has the technology changed since then? If so, how?
Well, virtual reality as a tool 10 years ago, or even more so, was being used as a tool. If you remember AI, they were using it as a tool to understand the virtual set that would eventually be composited. And then more recently, they're using the same kind of in-engine kind of approach to, I don't know if you saw behind the scenes on Mandalorian, where they're using a very large LED screen in lieu of a green screen.
Okay.
There's vibe tracking, or there's some form of tracking going on with where the camera is placed. So the camera is free to move, and it creates the parallax in the in-engine background. So then you're not really having to composite anybody, depending on this kind of scenes you're shooting.
Okay.
And for a show like Mandalorian, where you've got this guy with very reflective armor, it's a pain to key all that and recomp all of it. And it's much better if you can just capture that in camera. And so what they do is they build almost a full box and put the talent in it, excluding one wall. And it's reflecting up from the top down and from the sides. And then you're also able to dial in your depth of field focus and push it out of focus, but it's still parallaxing to where you're placing the camera. That's a great, wonderful use of a sort of an offshoot of that tool set that came out of the VR pre-production work for film.
So I was curious too, if you've had any thoughts about the limitations of the technology, because I remember when, James Cameron's Avatar came out in 2009 and, made so much money. And I think people in Hollywood and elsewhere saw dollar signs, and there was kind of an overexcitement about that. It wasn't just, that people thought all the movies are now going to be 3D, that Sony even, I think, bet really big on 3D television. And of course, the problem with that was that there are a lot of films that don't really have any use for 3D. Like I remember the one I always think of is Jules and Julia, which came out at around the same time, and the Julia Child story. And I'm like, seeing the Beef Bourguignon in 3D is not really going to enhance the show much.
I would love to talk to someone who's actually gone to see it in 3D. That's amazing.
And even in cases where 3D was potentially useful, I think people underestimated the skill that you needed to use it successfully. Mm-hmm. That James Cameron did an amazing job at using it in a way that didn't constantly get in your face. And I, when I was a kid, I remember one show I always think of. It was this 3D Western called Coming At Ya, and it was just. It was very, very well titled, because the whole show was just basically finding ways to throw things in the audience's face. There was a scene where the cowboys are waiting for the fight and they're bored, and one of them's just bouncing a ball off the wall. And so they're bouncing it off your face for however long. Yeah, it's sort of, as you described VR, it's 3D as a tool, and with proper skill, it can be really good, but it obviously has its limitations. And is that a fair comparison? Do you think VR has more applications, and are there areas where you think it might not be useful?
Yeah, I think yes. Okay, so I you're making me remember. My first foray or knowledge of 3D was when I picked up a ViewMaster at some friend's house and was looking at like a Fred Flintstone diorama in three dimensions, and that was that blew my mind. And then later, of course, much further back in history, when they were doing, these photographs, and they're picking up the left and right eye, and you put it in that little wooden thing and you'd slide it. I forget what those things are called. I remember picking one of those up at a grandparent's house and looking at that 3D photography. But the first time I saw a 3D movie was a wax museum, and with Vincent Price, my dad took me to it, and it was novel then because I was basically, you know, this was in early 80s. So this was like a film shot in the 60s. So it's like when I'm talking about like VR at Dave and Buster's in 1990, right? It's like we're coming through these waves, and every time it gets a little bit better, but still, it's still very novel. And I think it only works when it's more than just a gag, and it's serving the story. With that said, though, most of the time, you probably don't have a story that really warrants or justifies the need for that novel gimmick. And so I think a lot of people put their money into, because they were desperate to try to figure out how to bring people back into movie theaters, into this concept of, well, you can't do this at home, this 3D thing. So that's going to help put butts in seats for movie theaters. But obviously that's worn off. It's made the projectors dimmer. It's made the viewing experience less enjoyable because I wear glasses and I'm not going to go out and buy some prescription polarized lenses for 3D.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to do that. And then at the end of the day, now they're trying to – it feels like, at least to me here in Dallas-Fort Worth, that they've abandoned that even though it's still there. I don't see anybody buying a ticket because it's in 3D anymore. I see them buying a ticket maybe because they're hungry and they don't want to have to go somewhere else to eat dinner, and then they eat dinner in the theater. And then that becomes an annoyance for someone who really cares about the story because you got people dealing with receipts and credit cards in front of you throughout the entire movie. So I don't know if that's working either for getting people to go to the theaters. I think it's a rough time for not just movies, but just for all retail that are trying to get people out of their homes. It's a struggle to get people to leave their homes for entertainment.
Yeah, it's one. It, even for me specifically, like whenever I go see movies, and I see a lot of movies during the year because I write reviews. And so I intentionally avoid 3D movies because nothing about it strikes me. Like, because I'm more concerned about the story and the filmmaking technique. I'm not a gimmick person.
Right. I thought it was fun in Avatar. I enjoyed the three-dimensionality.
Yeah, and there
was
even, oh, yeah.
Monster sure. House had some really fun three-dimensional stuff. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. And it, I think, made it slightly better.
Yeah. But I think there are worlds in which that would be beneficial. Yeah, I'm not sure that there's a whole lot of movies that they're making these days that really would be – perfect. I think for the that reason kind of
potentially why you're bringing it up is because there's a lesson to be learned here, is not to get too enamored with these novel concepts. Exactly. But it's hard for an industry that's just struggling for anything.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Although, yeah, no, just as an aside, too, though, this morning I was messing around with Manifest 99. And
oh, cool.
I was struck by that. That actually felt like it was doing something I hadn't seen yet. Mm-hmm. Again, a lot of the VR games are variations on a theme. And that was just sort of, it was an interesting way of drawing me into a story that I had not yet seen. So that was sort of made me think, yeah, this is, every time you think you've seen everything that this can do, you realize, yeah, somebody clever can find a way to make it work in a way that's really interesting. So yes. And it'll be interesting to see what you can do when the technology is fully mature. Which is right. Probably still going to be a bit, but.
Yes. Well, thanks. I'm glad you got to check it out. And yes, we before we even started that project, we identified all the limitations. And then we said, what's the best thing for that we can do working with the limitations? Don't stray from them or hide them. Let's like embrace them. So let's intentionally design something artful that's low poly. Let's intentionally design something that doesn't require the controller to navigate through space. And I know that's kind of complex unless you've seen it, to just try to picture that in your mind if you're just listening to something like this. But the one thing that often happens that takes people out of the story in VR is when they can see the controller they're holding and then they punch a button to teleport to the next location they want to stand in because they're tethered to some computer or they're in some sort of boundary box based on their living room. So we came up with this idea to teleport by looking into the eyes of other characters and you snap into their body. And that kept us in narrative it worked toward the whole mystery of the narrative. And it didn't feel like, oh, I'm looking down at my hand now, or I'm holding this device and I'm punching a button, which just takes you out of it if you're trying to be on some sort of vintage train. Mm-hmm. It just feels odd to have some modern technology in your hand.
It was funny when I started using it. I was trying to figure out, wait, where are the controllers? And then I got it. But mm-hmm. it worked really well. But it was like, at first I was like, wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You have to teach. Yeah. And that's the other thing, is that elegantly, and I don't know if we did it just right on that one, but I think we all struggle to elegantly onboard people into learning how to navigate a user's interface.
Oh yeah.
And if you do it elegantly, you've done it in a way that they didn't even know you were teaching and that they were learning. And mm-hmm. so at the beginning, to launch the experience, you see that there's some sort of refractive thing happening. If you look in the eyes of the crow, and if you look the eyes dead center, it kind of all gets very symmetrical, and then it flashes. And then you go, oh, so it kind of makes this click in your brain. Oh, that's what I need to be doing every time I see a crow now.
Derooted is a proud sponsor of the 88 Names podcast. Derooted, immersive experiences and interactive activations helping brands connect globally. Find case studies and more at derooted.com.
So I don't want to get you in trouble with any of your peers, but I'm about to ask a question about the negative aspects of VR.
Yeah. So, we talk about it all the time.
Okay. Cool.
But we also, when we are using it as a medium, we in the office to either make something or actually make a VR product, we find ourselves wanting to spend more time in it, which mm-hmm. is good, I guess, and bad. I think a lot of people are expecting, oh, you know, people are on board into these things and haven't done it before, are going to get sick by the time they're like 5 minutes into it. It does require you to kind of do some neural rewiring when you do it, and getting mm-hmm. your bearings and not losing your balance. And there's certain things that are helpful to kind of keep that from happening. But the more you get acclimated to it, the more rules you get to break.
Yeah.
But as far as negative aspects of it, I think it has a lot of potential in the location-based entertainment space. As far as use at home, I'm always concerned about somebody like, you know, certain kids left unattended can just end up spending their whole lives in this thing the same way they spend their whole lives looking at their phone 5 inches from their face.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think everything's good in moderation, I guess. And it's just, you just got to be really careful with how much you do it at home, I guess.
Do you think that there's a
PlayStation VR is great, and they make some pretty compelling longer bits of gaming entertainment. Mm-hmm. And there's one of the best games that won an award a few years ago was Astrobot, and it is awesome. It is like Mario on steroids. But I mean, it's a long game. You're going to end up spending a good 14 hours in headset if you play it all the way through.
Wow.
And then I say that probably somebody else can get through it in 3 hours. I'm just not that good at it, but I really enjoy it. But man, once you take your headset off after however long you've been playing on a level, I mean, it's rough. And then the weirdest thing that's ever happened to me is like, we worked on this one project called War Remains, and I was in headset for long enough to where, I had kind of an out of body experience where I took the headset off and I was looking at my hands and I was having a hard time kind of discerning between what was real and what isn't. It's kind of like when you've been using an iPad for a long time and then you pick up a magazine and you pinch the picture on the magazine or it's like, oh, what am I doing? Yeah. It's like this weird thing that can happen if you do it for too long.
I actually did that the other day. Yeah. I can see that there's some spaces where it's just a matter of, it's almost jet lag. Whenever you're mm-hmm. switching between actual reality and virtual or augmented. And so, yeah, I see that even just in the obsessive nature of uses of my own phone.
Right.
Whenever I've been looking at it a long time, like I look mm-hmm. up and my eyes have to refocus and my shoulders mm-hmm. are tense. And so you're just, mm-hmm. you're having to reacclimate to the actual reality that you're in.
Yeah.
So So Flight School Studios has recently been involved in the creation of an experience of World War One entitled War Remains.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about that project and how you perceive experiences like this informing the public about a time that they were not alive during.
Right. So the spawn of this idea came from a guy named Dan Carlin, who had recently connected with the studio who funded it and produced this called Madison Wells Media. And the two of them got to talking, and Dan was like, you know, the one thing that I always struggle with when I'm trying to tell my podcast history stories on wars is to get somebody in the shoes of that person that experienced this for real. If only I had a time travel machine. Mm-hmm. And VR in a way can be used as a tool to kind of use it like a time travel machine. So that was his wish. That was where he kind of threw the gauntlet down. And so when they came to us and they asked me to direct it, that was the challenge. It was like, can you teleport me to the past and put me right there on the front lines in one of the most intense battles during World War One? And all these other narrative challenges, of course, sprang up from just that conversation, which was, well, Dan, you're your podcaster, and if it's your brand that we're expanding upon, if your fans are going to hear your voice. And he's like, I don't want anybody to hear my voice. I just want to put people in the experience. It's like, well, okay, let's find that balance between you setting it up, because we're not going to be in it for 30 hours like the length of some of your podcasts. Like, but we're going to just be in it for 15 minutes. And to cover the context of cover something as daunting as World War One, it's going to be tricky, but we need you to be our docent here in the museum. We need you to set it up verbally and get us into the right mm-hmm. headspace, so that when we snap over to the other side, we have a deeper context so that we're seeing it through the proper eyes. That was how we kind of found that balance between narrative setup with Dan's voice and then putting you in it. And we found three moments, beginning, middle, and end, for him to chime in, but gave you time also to just be present and explore and just be there without a voice taking you out of it. That was mm-hmm. really important for us to find that balance. So what we do in War Remains is we designed this originally to be a movable 3D, like fully immersive walkabout for people to step into the trenches of the war, be on the front lines, and get a taste of several aspects of the horrors of World War One. Mm-hmm. What I wanted us to do was to surprise and delight. Delight is probably not the right word, but surprise. And constantly, you may have, with anything, if you see a movie trailer or whatever, or you see a book cover, you have an expectation for something. But when you may have seen something for this, when you walk into it, you're not going to expect all of a sudden be in a gondola of a balloon, which they used a lot of during the war to get a better understanding of the battlefield. Okay. And it helped as an establishing shot to kind of get you to descend into the battlefield. And there was an opportunity there for more context while Dan spoke on the drawing board that normally the soldier would be drawing the trenches lines on. But instead, we have a motion graphics piece that's happening on the board in front of you, as well as actually planes and starlights being shot up around you. And what seems like thunder and lightning in the clouds, quickly learn is shelling and gunfire on the ground. And then eventually you kind of go into this dark cloud, and then snap, you're into the front lines. But then we had to design physical spaces that could work for these transitions, changes. And also we wanted everything to be haptic. So if you touch the edge of that gondola, you feel the raw rope. If you step out into the trench, you feel the wobbly duck boards under your feet. If you reach out, touch the periscope, it's physically there. The glass feels like glass. The metal feels like metal. The barbed wire feels like barbed wire, but doesn't cut you. But all of that stuff is in there, and it's sort of dreamlike. We chose not to show your hands, because when you show hands in VR, it doesn't interpolate arms and elbows right now. And if it does, it gets kind of janky, and then it'll take you out of it. So it's sort of a dream state. It's like almost like there's some sort of seance going on, and you've been brought into this sort of like Twilight Zone space of getting a taste of it, but still you're not seeing yourself. But when you raise your hand out, it's there to be touched. Even the dead body's arm is there if you choose to touch it. It's all there. So if you're seeing it, it's touchable. Mm-hmm. And and you zigzag and get disoriented throughout the trench as you walk around in it. And we gate people. There's a bunker you go into, and when you go into it, the door behind you locks. We use electromagnetic locks in certain zones that then we unlock the door that's the exit. When you see a door virtually close, you just assume there's actually a door there. Sometimes it's not really, but it helps gate people in how you move people through a space. So there's a lot of spatial planning that went into what felt like the right movement, the right orientation. But one of the biggest things about creating an experience is that you can't tell a person where to look. And so therefore you need to constantly think about what's behind them, what's next to them, what's under them, what's above them, and give them opportunities for discovery, surprises. So if you chose to look in the periscope, you're going to see soldiers struggling ahead of you in the front lines. If you choose to look down, you may see body parts. If you choose to look to your left, you may see a rat running along the edge of a trench wall. It's all there, yeah. And it's all there to be discovered. And the thing is, we think about the conversations people have after they do this. We think about like, well, someone's going to say, well, did you see this? No, I didn't see that. Did you see that? No, I didn't see that. That's what I enjoy about doing these things is we're creating this conversation that can happen afterwards. Yeah. And we're creating unique memories for people, opportunities for unique memories. Some people just like, no, I hunkered in a corner. I didn't want to get hit in the head by a shell. there's everybody does it differently. And what was also important is at the end of the experience, we had an offboarding zone. We quickly discovered that you can't just throw somebody back into the food court after this is over. You got to give them time to kind of digest what they've seen and have a decompression zone. So we intentionally designed a space for somebody after they've taken the headset off to kind of like not be inundated with people in line or whatever is outside in the real world. It's just have this little chamber you can chill in. And there's a little podium with a book, a leather bound book that has whomever has come before you in the experience. Sometimes they write down their thoughts or feelings after they've come right out of this thing. And there's a lot of really great emotional paragraphs that have been written in this book. It's half full now, and people sometimes read it and they add to it. And it serves almost like a memorial in that sense. Like it was important for us to pay homage to all those lives lost during the war and to do it justice. So we didn't hold back gore, we didn't hold back violence, but at the same time, we couldn't have people come into this and come out of it with PTSD. So we had to find that line. If there was a soldier alive today that had experienced World War I, I would be embarrassed to show it to him because I know it's still not even scratching the surface of how horrible it was. But at the same time, we didn't want to be light.
How do you handle crowd management in a thing like that? And because can people see each other or they go through one at a time?
Well, there wasn't a lot of concern about throughput going into this. There was the desire to get people about every 2 to 5 minutes into it, which we accomplished. Okay. So we were able to rotate that quickly. Had there been a bigger concern about throughput, we could have potentially designed it to where it was just like this constant moving queue about a person every 30 feet. But with something like that, that gets more expensive and changes a little bit of how you would think about the narrative and how it would work. Because sometimes people stand in one spot and listen to Dan talking for 5 minutes. So we knew what was wanted and desired in the project, and we worked with that. But we care greatly about throughput, and we always want to improve upon that. An experience like this, I think, achieved all the goals that Madison Wells had for us as far as the way it will be accepted for museums as it moves forward and tours. So, you know, it had a stint in Austin for 3 months, and then now it's being set up in L.A. for some previews. And then it's going to go to the World War Museum in Missouri. Okay. And then hopefully it'll move off the continent to other places where there's other museums for the war.
So this discussion kind of touches on my next question, which is present-day VR focuses, you know, primarily on sight and sound and to a lesser extent on touch and proprioception. But fictional representations of VR obviously often go a lot further, including things like the full body haptic suits that you have in like Ready Player One, and you know, even further on, you know, the mind machine interfaces of William Gibson fantasy. Mm-hmm. And then there are goofier things too, like in 88 Names, there's a point where the protagonist is remembering shopping at a cyber sex toy shop with his girlfriend in Japan, and there's the Japanese have invented something called a smell synthesizer. And, you know, he decides not to buy this because he doesn't want to pay a ridiculous amount of money to have patchouli blown up his nose. And that's just not his kink. But So I was just wondering, though, if you had an unlimited research budget to explore extensions of VR that don't exist yet, do you have a wish list of things, goofy or not, that you would like to see or experiment with?
Yeah, well, we just finished an experiment, which was really great over the last few days. So as it relates to War Remains, you know, there's a desire to have a home port. So we've been building the home port version so you can have a version of what it was like to do War Remains physically on a set, but now at home. So it's a little different. You're not going to have the set at home. But, you know, with creating a home port version, there's also all the marketing materials required. So it was a desire to create a new trailer. So having the opportunity to make a new trailer for it, I wanted to have a different tone to it. So this time I was like, well, we have the virtual set. I want to make a virtual camera that feels like somebody, like a Lumiere brother, figured out how to make a handheld hand crank camera and was on the front lines with a hand crank, like handheld camera running around. Much like the, I don't know if you ever saw the CBS reporting from the front lines of Vietnam, sometimes these press and cameramen got caught in the kind of combat, and there's this wonderful, terrifying handheld camera work going on while combat's happening around them. So I wanted to capture that feeling. And so what we did is I took two bricks from my, like a stockpile of bricks I have in my house for weight, took some cardboard and some foam, took a Vive controller and rigged up what felt like a handheld camera, like you would see in the 80s, like a guy. And then, so it has the right weight and movement to it. And then we built a virtual camera. So then we went in our screening room and we have a very large projection on two walls, facing north, facing south. Then we put the live feed up on those two walls. And then I'm able to roam around in this large room when we moved all the chairs out. And I felt like I was walking in there again, even though I didn't have the set around me. So I was able to collide with Geo, which isn't ideal. But if I kind of got my bearings right, I could picture where things were in space. And then I could run around as if I were dodging and ducking, more movement than you could potentially do even in the set piece, because you'd be worried you're going to run into a wall or something. But this definitely gave a totally different vibe. We put a Zoom control on there too. So it really does feel like somebody who's trying to document what's going on is truly in the battle. And I'm really happy with the results. And it was a fun tool. And it's not unlike tools that were being used on like Lion King, Jon Favreau with Lion King. He was able to work with virtual sets and move a virtual camera around real time and get a sense of where things should be. So it's sort of we built our own version of it just the other day, and we've got it now, proof of concept working. We were able to do live captures over the last 3 days with it, which has been great. So that trailer will be coming out soon. You'll see what I'm talking about. And that's been a great tool. So as far as new tools, going back to your question of like what would be like a ideal thing that doesn't exist at that, or if their budget money was no issue, like what would I want to have to push the medium further? I often think about, again, trying to make these things more communal. And also I think it's going to be really important, I think, for the location-based entertainment world to continue to kind of step up their game on throughput. Putting more people in these experiences, the better. The more people can have these magical moments together as a group, can be really special if it's in a controlled environment with potential set pieces. I like the idea of thinking about, you know, immersive theater, where it's a combination of everything. It's a combination of sets, some practical effects, but then also when necessary and when, if we wanted to, in VR, take over your headset and just completely take you somewhere we couldn't take you. But then other times toggle you back into a present state where you're actually in a room with real set pieces and props. So, but to do that in a building that's multiple stories with lots of people, I think that's, we're kind of getting into something really special and unique there. That's my wish, is to continue to figure out ways to wire all these headsets together to where we're all seeing and we're all present, seeing the same thing at the same time. Without having the bulkiness of backpack computers or wires getting in the way.
A lot of it is just making stuff lighter and smaller and more transparent, which is,
How do you think immersive technology benefits society and culture at large? And do you think it benefits, its benefits will extend into realms beyond entertainment?
Okay, so we just did this thing for Verizon and 5G at the Pro Bowl. There was a domed theater where we were projecting real time from 360 cameras on the field. We attached one of these cameras to the bottom of the cable cam, Skycam rig that was floating over the game. And then we had a separate truck where we were directing the broadcast and toggling between cameras, you know, running it like its own sort of separate second unit production broadcast, right? Mm-hmm. And that was going into a dome theater for a select few people who were in that theater, and they're able to watch the game and fly like a, literally like a fly over the field. And there was editorial happening too. So it would cut to the sidelines, cut back over the huddle. It was moving around, and it was giving real time broadcast a whole new dimension. And you know, the whole point of it was just to showcase 5G. And can you restate your question? I had a train of thought there, totally derailed. Sure.
No, you're good. How do you think immersive technology benefits society and culture at large?
All right. So imagine that doing what I was just describing, but doing it real time. So, if you need to get somebody to truly understand, not just physically, but emotionally, what's going on somewhere else. It's one thing to throw a headset on them. It would be another if you could really kind of one-to-one give them that space. It would be terrifying and hopefully resonate deeper emotionally so that you care greater and you actually can't turn your eyes away from whatever is going on in different corners of the world that truly need our attention. So think about Syria, for example. There was some sort of drone camera 360 unit you could fly into a village where there's innocent bystanders who are trying to live regular lives, and then to be able to just go to the UN, have a room and toggle it on, and not be this solitary thing one person puts on a headset for, but literally it's just live and it's just that's you're there now and there's no hiding it. And you and five other delegates in their suits can't turn their eyes away from it or whomever. Like, I think there's something really interesting and powerful if we're able to do that.
It's a matter of confrontation. You're not able to just stick it to statistics or something like that. You're actually there and you're seeing it. That makes sense.
Take it to the border of Mexico and Texas. Do the same thing. Very much. And then have this be touring malls.
That's a really interesting idea.
I could see that being really actually beneficial, but also angering for some people.
And then that's a good thing. To communicate on both sides. There's a thing that happened many years ago called Conflict Kitchen. I would say it was in Manhattan. And they basically just video projected on one wall in this little pop-up kitchen where they would serve the ethnic food of whatever this war-torn country that's in conflict. But you were able to have and break bread with people via Skype over of this one video projected wall. So you walk into this little cafe and you may be on the line with people in Afghanistan. You may be on the line with people in Iraq and you're breaking bread with them. It was called Conflict Kitchen. So a little bit of that.
Well, I guess the sort of traditional wrap up question, I always like to know what people are working on next. So what are you up to now?
The home port, like I was explaining earlier, for War Remains, and we'll be done with that soon. But there's the relationship with Madison Wells has grown. We really like working together. There are three original titles that we're making for the traditional video game space together. So there's three originals that are going to come out of Flight School that we're making and working on right now. And they'll come out on traditional platforms like, you know, Xbox, PlayStation, Switch, that kind of space. And we're excited to, you know, bring our indie spirit to the table with our unique sort of approach to storytelling and games that way. And that's an ongoing production. But the I think the Mount Everest project for our company is to be able to have a brick and mortar space where we're able to create immersive entertainment and charge, you know, tickets at the door, have a gift shop you enter and exit out of, and to really make a wonderful experience for people to share with their friends and families, but give them a space where they can maybe grab a bite to eat first or have a drink after, give them the space to be able to talk about what they're going to do or what they did, and give people experiences versus things. So to expand on this concept of storytelling and it replace in some ways some of this entertainment that fails in the shopping malls. We know that all these retail establishments are hungry for magnets, for something new and exciting. And we feel like we have a new piece of entertainment we can bring to the table for all these empty boxes that are around, like the vacant Sears or the vacant Macy's or the vacant Forever 21 or the vacant Toys R Us. Mm-hmm. We feel like we have something exciting and new to offer to fill those boxes with that are going to get people out of their homes and do something fun together.
Well, I hope you come to Seattle. This sounds great.
We would love to come to Seattle. Yeah, that's a pie in the sky wish, but we're taking strides towards that. It could happen. So we'll keep trying.